This week in Britain, the publication of the Savile Report, passing what presumably is the final judgment on what led to British soldiers killing 13 people and fatally wounding another during a civil rights march in the Northern Ireland city of Londonderry on January 30, 1972. I say final judgment because an official investigation launched soon after Bloody Sunday laid the blame on the marchers. The Savile Report reached the opposite conclusion. It found that the soldiers' attack was entirely unprovoked and that some civilians were shot even as they crawled away. Here's British Prime Minister David Cameron on Tuesday.
I never want to believe anything bad about our country. I never want to call into question the behaviour of our soldiers and our army, who I believe to be the finest in the world. Yeah. But the conclusions of this report are absolutely clear. What happened on Bloody Sunday was both unjustified and unjustifiable. It was wrong.
Former Prime Minister Tony Blair ordered the Savile investigation in 1998. 12 years later, it has finally set the record straight. In a story we did in 2002, we noted that among the thousands of people to give evidence to the Savile investigators were several reporters who were on the ground in Londonderry in 1972.
There I was sitting in my Manhattan apartment 27 years later, and the phone goes. And it's the Savile Inquiry in London announcing to me that they have five of my notebooks, which I had used during the time that I was in Derry in 1972. And I have to say I was shocked.
Peter Pringle was an investigative reporter with the Sunday Times in London when he was sent in by his editor, Harold Evans, to try and determine what happened in Derry that Sunday. All was confusion and contradiction in Derry. A civil rights march was underway, but no organized violence was planned by the Catholic side. The IRA had even declared it was taking the day off. Police and British regulars were tactically deployed, armed, as always, with purple dye-firing water cannons and rubber bullets, all except the paratroopers, straight from service in Cyprus. They had their standard self-loading rifles.
Tell me what happened when the paratroopers came in, Father.
They came in and they just came in firing. The people, there was no provocation whatsoever.
Firing what, rubber bullets?
No, it was lead bullets they fired.
A short while ago, we filmed you leading the way with a white handkerchief.
Yes.
For a party who were carrying a boy who was dead or dying. Now, how was he shot?
That little boy was shot when he was running away.
I don't believe they were shot in the back running away. A lot of us, in fact, do think that some of the people were shot by their own indiscriminate firing.
General Robert Ford, commander of the land forces in Ireland, said they intended only to separate the stone-throwing hooligans from hundreds of peaceful marchers and arrest them. And he denied the evidence that lay in the streets of Derry. The editor of the Sunday Times was Harold Evans, a journalist with an investigative bent, frequently brought before the bar for various violations of Britain's Official Secrets Act and privacy and libel laws.
The government announced that it was setting up an inquiry by Lord Widgery, and a notice came to all the editors that we should await Widgery's report to see what actually happened. After talking to him, we decided what we should do was mount a parallel inquiry by sending our very best people over to Northern Ireland so that when Widgery came out, we would be able to say, an excellent report, or, as in fact we did say, Widgery is a whitewash.
Our idea was that we would get at the truth, and we would probably get closer to the truth than the Widgery inquiry. You know, they didn't have the access that we did.
Peter Pringle.
It was a curious thing to be a reporter in Northern Ireland because you could, in the morning, go to the normal press briefing of the British troops. And in the afternoon, you could cross the line, if you like, and go and talk to the IRA leaders.
But the most telling bit of evidence collected by Pringle and his reporting partner, Philip Jacobson, were the audio tapes, complete with time codes of the Army's radio communications, taped surreptitiously by a local shop owner.
Every afternoon, when the aggro started and the young Derry hooligans, as the Army caught them, started throwing stones, Mr. Porter of the Porter's television would go up into his upstairs room and record the army messages. And he made a full recording on this day.
Vera, this is 76, two high-velocity shots heard in the area of the Rossville flat. People are lying on the ground now.
It was a stunning piece of evidence, which the British government inquiry under Lord Widgery rejected. Why did they reject it? They rejected it because they said it had been made in sort of clandestinely and was against the Official Secrets Act and couldn't be used in evidence. Well, of course, if you don't use the tape, then you can't reconstruct the day.
Soon after the Widgery inquiry was released, exonerating the British Army of any wrongdoing, Pringle and Jacobson published their 12,000-word account of Bloody Sunday in the Sunday Times. Conservative members of Parliament accused Harold Evans of betraying his country, but otherwise, the story barely made a ripple, and it sank, under the weight of Widgery and a largely unsympathetic public, into a sea of subsequent events.
It was so fast-moving that nobody had time to stop and examine the difference between the government's report and our report, but it had no shelf life beyond about a week. After Bloody Sunday, there was Bloody Friday, there was Bloody Wednesday, there was Bloody Thursday, and more people died in a single event in those bombings and shootings than they did at Bloody Sunday.
How did they get into this mess?
Harold Evans.
There were so many theories being bandied around that had no basis in fact. So-and-so is saying it's all the fault of Lloyd George, or so-and-so is all the fault of the IRA, or it's all the fault of De Valera or Michael Collins. But what are the facts? And so once you resolve to get into the facts of the situation, you have a tremendous momentum to continue until you've nailed as far as you can that shadowy, elusive thing called truth.
The frustration of investigative work is that you may see it and feel it and even write it, but you only have one chance to get out the word, unless by some miracle it comes around again, which brings us back to Pringle and his mouldering notebooks, which had languished for 27 years in the archives of the Sunday Times until the Saville inquiry demanded the Times hand them over, and the paper, under the aegis of managing editor Richard Casby and owner Rupert Murdoch, complied.
I wondered immediately what my notebooks looked like. I wondered immediately what on earth they might contain that I didn't want anybody else to know. I wondered whether they would want me to translate them from my very shaky shorthand, and why I would do that, and whether I should do that.
Pringle finally determined that he should, though he won't divulge his sources, as Lord Saville demands. He doesn't actually believe that Lord Saville will arrive at the truth. Too many people are dead, or they can no longer remember, or they remain silent still. But he does hope for a proper reckoning for the people of Derry.
Think of this. 13 people died on Bloody Sunday. The compensation that was worked out 2 years after the event for the four teenagers who died was £250 per dead body given to the relatives. When I first heard this, I thought to myself, I would love to end this book with an interview with the civil servant who signed the cheque to give £250 to the mother of a teenager who was shot in the back.
As it turned out, Pringle was overly pessimistic. As victims and their families gathered at the Guildhall in Derry on Tuesday, they saw the truth emerge after all. It took approximately 2,500 witnesses, 160 volumes of evidence, and nearly 200 million British pounds. Peter Pringle, when did you start to believe it would work?
Well, only on the day of publication, which was on June the 15th, basically. Everybody who went into the Derry Guildhall, the lawyers for the dead and wounded, the relatives for the dead and wounded, simply didn't know what Saville was going to say. They opened the boxes and they were given 2 hours to read it before Cameron's speech. And the relatives of the dead and wounded gave the thumbs up sign, and the whole crowd outside just erupted in clapping and cheering and clenched fists into the air. So it was right up to the last minute that nobody was really certain about it.
You wrote recently in The Guardian that the Saville Commission seemed to subscribe to a Rankean view of history. Can you summarize that?
Well, basically what 19th century German historian Leopold von Ranke said, if you're reconstructing history, dip your bucket as close to the source as possible. Or, if you like to put it another way, a witness's second thoughts about what happened are probably unhelpful. you know, he's had second thoughts about it. It's been tainted in some way.
In other words, your unassuming little notebooks were where the bucket was closest to the original event.
Yes. What do we say? Journalism is the first cut of history. We probably took the first statements of the witnesses. Then they made their own statements to the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association. Then some of them made statements to that first inquiry. And then they finally made another statement to the Savile inquiry. So when they actually got into the witness box in front of the Savile inquiry, they had three or four versions of what they believed at the time and then could remember 30, 40 years later. But it was quite extraordinary to see Savile take our original notes and then from there build this case. And curiously enough, Savile was not a criminal lawyer. He's a contract lawyer. And so everybody thought when he was appointed that it's a long way from the courts of contract law to dead bodies in the bogside. That's what his colleagues said behind his back. And so they thought he would be completely swamped and wouldn't ever get anywhere near what he did get. And that's why others, including myself, were skeptical.
Peter, thank you so much.
Well, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Peter Pringle is co-author with Philip Jacobson of Those Are Real Bullets and Bloody Sunday, January 30th, 1972, and most recently of The Murder of Nikolai Vavilov.